This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We have two things before us today. First, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is going to make a presentation on its proposed sulfate standard. And then we have Senate File 1007 from Senator Tomasoni related to the application of wild rice water quality standards. We're going to start with the MPCA, and I believe, I'm not sure who, Assistant Commissioner Flood. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Flood. For the record, I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and we appreciate the opportunity today to present to you our draft proposal for protecting wild rice from excess sulfate, which is the result of a 2011 legislation that really propelled the science forward on this topic. We have involved a lot of folks along the way. We have an advisory committee. We have that also include members of tribal governments in their staff in that committee, as well as other interested stakeholders from a wide variety of interests. We released our proposal to the public for initiate discussion on that this past Tuesday. This draft proposal is a step in an ongoing effort to further understand the effects of sulfate on wild rice, to protect this important resource, and to ensure that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's water quality standards are based on the most up-to-date science. First off, I want to emphasize that everything we're presenting today is draft. We're not yet in formal rulemaking. We have not made a decision. At this point, we are sharing a proposal, and we're looking for input before we finalize the package into a draft rule, which will then go through the administrative procedures process. The PCA will be scheduling meetings with interested stakeholders and tribal governments to further describe and get input on the proposal, and we'll continue to refine the proposal based on feedback and any new data that we receive. We anticipate having a rulemaking package ready by late summer or early fall of this year. This package will include proposed rule language, the detailed technical support information for the proposal, as well as a statement of need and reasonableness. The package will also include a draft list of wild rice waters and the criteria that we've used to develop that list, and that we will use those draft criteria once they're finalized to add waters to the list into the future. Rulemaking will include explaining the need for and the scientific basis underlying the proposed changes, formal public comment opportunities, and a hearing before an administrative law judge. So let me reemphasize that this is a draft proposal. We're just really at milepost 4 of the marathon. So we've done some work. There's a whole lot more to do, and we look forward to sharing the proposal with you at this time. I'd like to have our director of our Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division, Shannon Lotthammer, talk about the scientific proposal.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lotthammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Shannon Lotthammer, the director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division, and I also have a background in aquatic ecology. So this topic has been very interesting to me, both from a leadership position at the agency, but also from a scientific position as well. And before I get into explaining our draft approach for protecting wild rice from too much sulfate, I'd like to address two questions that I've heard repeatedly over the last couple of days since we've released that draft the draft approach. And the first question that I've heard and you've heard and others have heard is, well, what about the 10 milligrams per liter standard, the existing standard? And as Commissioner Flood has been quoted as saying in the media, the current standard is not incorrect, but it is imprecise. And what we mean by that is, for example, while the past research has shown that wild rice tends to grow most readily when sulfate concentrations are low in places with lower sulfate concentrations, it couldn't explain why we do see places like the lower part of the Mississippi River where we have wild rice growing in large stands of wild rice at higher sulfate concentrations. We also didn't know leading into this research what it was about sulfate that was creating the problem for wild rice. We suspected that it had to do with sulfate actually being converted into a different form of sulfur called sulfide, and it's known that sulfide is a form of sulfur that's quite toxic to plants and animals, so we thought that might be what was going on. But the research to either confirm or not confirm that just hadn't been done. So the second question that I've heard a lot over the last couple of days is, why is the PCA making this so complicated? And when I get into explaining what the proposal is, you'll know what I mean by so complicated if you haven't delved into the information yet. So again, this question references our proposed approach, which I'll walk through in a moment. And it's the proposed approach to identify the protective value of sulfate at a given water where wild rice is growing that takes into account conditions that are specific to each of those wild rice waters. Well, we're proposing this approach because that's where the scientific data and analysis have led us. We believe that the draft approach more accurately would protect wild rice from too much sulfate. And that's what I'm here to explain to you today and the information that we have at this point. But again, as Rebecca Flood noted, we welcome feedback and comments, and we will be considering additional information as it becomes available as well. So again, the study to help us better understand sulfate in wild rice, which has led us to this proposed approach, originated in 2011, and it included sampling 112 Minnesota water bodies, both lakes, streams, and wetlands, as well as laboratory experiments and container experiments where wild rice was grown under different sulfate and sulfide conditions. And the approach that we're proposing is to determine the protective sulfate concentration for a wild rice water by measuring the iron and the organic carbon in the sediment, so the muck where the wild rice is growing, and actually entering that specific data into an equation to identify the protective sulfate level at a given site. I want to emphasize that this proposed equation would be the same for every site. This relationship between sulfate and sulfide and other variables that I'll explain in a minute holds true from site to site to site. But what's different is that the amount of iron and the amount of organic carbon varies from one site to the other, and that's what has led us to this proposed approach. So at this point, to further explain this, I'd like to direct your attention to the 11 by 17 handout that you all have on the committee, and it's the same as the poster board that's behind me. So in analyzing the results of the study, what we found is what we suspected, that sulfate affects wild rice by being converted to the toxic form of sulfur, sulfide, in the sediment where wild rice is rooted. And that's a process that's done by bacteria that live in that sediment, and that sulfide can then affect the wild rice and create conditions that are less favorable for wild rice to grow and to self-perpetuate over time. We can use the data from the study to actually determine what is the level of sulfide then that we need to be concerned about. What do we want to try to prevent as far as the levels of sulfide in order to make sure that we're protecting wild rice? And that's what's depicted in the lower right-hand corner of the diagram that you see. Basically, what this is showing is that based on the data collected from those 112 sites across Minnesota, we looked at how much wild rice was growing, we looked at how much sulfide was in the sediment, as well as a lot of other factors, and we saw that there was this relationship between the probability that wild rice is present and the concentration of sulfide in the sediment. And as the sulfide concentration went up, the probability that wild rice would be present at any given site went down. So we could fit an equation to that and go through a process that's typical in developing toxicity-based standards and look at what is the concentration of sulfide then where we see a 10% decrease in that probability. And that's what this diagram shows, and that sulfide concentration is 165 micrograms per liter. So that was the first key finding of our analysis and the first kind of building block of the draft proposal. Then the next thing that we learned from the study results is that certain factors that are found at wild rice waters can change the rate at which or affect the rate at which sulfate in the overlying water is converted into sulfide in the sediment. And that's what all of the information in the upper right-hand quadrant of the infographic is about. So when we went out into the field sites, we measured a lot of different things. We looked at sulfate in the water. We looked at nutrients. We measured sulfide in the sediment, iron and organic carbon and metals and all sorts of different things in the sediments. And we analyzed all of that information to see what was playing a statistically significant role in that relationship and understanding the relationship between wild rice, sulfate in the water column, and sulfide in the sediment. And what we found was that two of the key environmental variables that we measured were total organic carbon and total extractable iron found in the sediment where the wild rice was growing. Most significantly, we found that higher levels of iron in the sediment can lead to lower amounts of sulfide being produced from the sulfate and then affecting the wild rice, whereas conversely, lower or higher levels of organic carbon can lead to higher levels of sulfide being produced. So the iron and the organic carbon really act as regulators or enhancers on that relationship and on that conversion of sulfate in the water to sulfide in the sediment. And that's because this is a biologically mediated effort. We have those bacteria that are doing their thing, and as a part of doing their thing, turning sulfate into sulfide. And the more carbon that we have, carbon acts as a food to those bacteria. So the more carbon, the more bacteria, the more opportunity for sulfide to be produced. Conversely, the way iron actually enters into this approach is that iron very readily binds with sulfide that is found in the sediment. And when that happens, it creates a solid, a precipitate, that then isn't available to, or at least we believe isn't available to, affect the wild rice. So it, as sulfide is being produced, there's less potential for toxicity with wild rice because the iron is pulling that out of the system. So it's this relationship between sulfate, sulfide, iron, and organic carbon that led us to developing a draft equation to model that relationship amongst these variables. And we looked at other variables, but really the strongest way to depict what was going on was looking at those four things happening in the environment. Then the equation is valuable because then if you set the sulfide concentration at that protective level that we talked about, that 165 micrograms per liter, then you can actually use that model to come up with an equation that if you know what the iron is at a site, you know what the organic carbon is at a site, we know how much sulfide we believe is too much based on the other research that was done, you can plug iron and organic carbon into the equation and then figure out what level of sulfate is a protective level for a particular site. So if you turn to the back of your handout, you'll see how that information then plays out. The handout shows you both the draft equation that we've developed based on understanding that relationship and from that field data, and then also examples of how that equation might play out at three Minnesota lakes that we measured and sampled as a part of the study, all of which contain wild rice beds. So three places where wild rice is growing in Minnesota. Now, there's four things that I'd like to point out in particular about the information on the back of the handout. First of all, the three examples that we provide here are undeveloped lake sheds. So these are lakes that don't have obvious sources of discharge of sulfate or anything else that's coming into those water bodies. So they're kind of reference conditions. They're more natural conditions. There's not a lot of development or impacts that are happening around them. The second part of that is that the equation that you see then on the page or on the backside of the page, you don't see sulfide in the equation. The reason why you don't is because that's already built into the numbers. So in developing that equation, we set sulfide at that 165 micrograms per liter, what we're proposing as the protective level, and then turn to the equation around so that we can use that to develop what level of sulfate is protective. The equation is the same equation for every site in the example because that relationship holds true from site to site to site. But if you look at the table, you'll see that what's different from one site to the next is how much total organic carbon and how much iron is found in the sediment. And what that means is that when you then plug those measured variables into that equation, you end up with different protective levels of sulfate at each of the sites. In these examples, it ranges from 0.8 milligrams per liter to 140 milligrams per liter. And again, these are sites where wild rice is growing and was growing when we went out and sampled those sites. These are sites that are in unimpacted areas, just for example purposes. The last thing that I want to point out is this is very much draft. As Rebecca noted earlier, we are putting the proposal out to get feedback and to get additional information. And as new information becomes available, we'll evaluate that. And if we need to, we will certainly make adjustments to the proposed approach and the proposed equation based on that additional information. So I want to make that clear. This is not a decision or a proposal of specific numbers, but we're looking at the equation, and then we'll evaluate additional information as it comes forward. So again, we're proposing this equation approach because although the relationship between iron, carbon, sulfide, and sulfate holds steady from one water body to the next, we're seeing variability across the state in how much iron and how much total organic carbon at any given site is found at any given site. Of those 112 sites that we measured, we looked for patterns in that data. Are there patterns from north to south or east to west? Is there regional patterns? Is there a pattern for lakes versus wetlands versus streams? And there just wasn't. And that's really what led us to this proposed equation approach. So to account for what level of sulfide do we need to worry about, but then to recognize that there are conditions that are specific to each site that plays into that overall relationship and that then can be accounted for in order to figure out the protective level of sulfate. So we believe that the draft approach would more accurately protect wild rice from too much sulfate, and that's why we're proposing it, but we absolutely want to get feedback on that. And as further information and analysis comes forward, we will evaluate that and consider any changes or refinements that we need as we head into rulemaking and even during rulemaking. So at this point, I kind of talked through the proposed approach to identifying the protective level of sulfate. One of the other questions that we looked at, and that's part of this proposal, is where would the standard apply? So what are we proposing as far as what is a wild rice water? And I'd like to turn the presentation over to my colleague, Katrina Kessler, who's the manager of our water assessment section, to explain that part of the proposal.
Ms. Kessler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Katrina Kessler. I'm the manager of the water assessment section at the Pollution Control Agency, as Shannon mentioned, and I have a background in environmental engineering. So the microbiology and the chemistry of this is something that's near and dear to me academically and professionally. And at this point, I want to draw your attention to the left-hand side of the 11 by 17 handout. As Shannon explained, our proposed approach not only includes an explanation of the science behind the equation and the equation itself, but also a draft list of waters where the standard would apply over time, and we're calling these wild rice waters, along with a draft proposed definition to add waters to that list over time. The list includes 1,300 waters and was developed in concert with Minnesota Tribes, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, wild rice harvesters, and includes information collected as part of our studies, as Shannon explained, as well as surveys collected by other entities, including wastewater discharges. In developing the draft criteria and the draft list of wild waters, we considered factors such as the minimum acreage and density of wild rice in a location and use by not only humans but also wildlife. And the proposed definition that we're proposing to use to add waters not only to the initial list, which we will adopt through rulemaking, is lakes that have more than 8,000 stems of rice over the surface of a given lake, and flowing waters, rivers that have more than 800 stems over one river mile, recognizing that rice grows differently in flowing systems as opposed to lakes. There's an interactive map of the proposed wild rice waters on our website, as well as a link to an FTP site that has all of the locations and the names of the waters. And again, I want to emphasize that this is a draft list of waters that we are looking to adopt as part of the rulemaking package described by both Rebecca and Shannon, and that during this interim period before rulemaking, we're looking for more information about additional waters that might meet this proposed definition to be included in the rule as we go forward. We also recognize that over time we will need to add waters to the list, that this is not the extensive, exhaustive universe of wild rice waters in the state, and that going forward we're committed to adding waters that meet that proposed definition once the rule is adopted through official rulemaking over time. So at this point, all three of us are happy to entertain questions about the science behind the approach, the equation, or the proposed wild rice waters that committee members may have.
Thank you to all three of you. I had one question, and that is it is more complex formula. My question is, you talk about analyzing the amount of iron and the organic carbon in the sediment, and I'm wondering, doesn't that vary hugely, not just from lake to lake, but also parts of lakes? And if so, how do you figure that out, and does that change from time to time, either seasonally or year to year? And if so, I mean, is this something somebody's going to have to be measuring monthly, yearly? I mean, do the standards change on a lake?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the data that we have to date through the study suggests that those measurements don't change from year to year, although the data set is limited and we do need to look at that further. Regarding the variability kind of across the lake, that is something that we need to investigate further. We're actually hoping to do some additional monitoring this summer as we're heading into rulemaking to further understand that variability so that when it comes to proposing how to implement the standard, we'll be able to answer questions like, you know, if you have five samples, well, first of all, how many samples do you need to collect? And then once you get those samples, do you average them? Do you take a percentage? How do you interpret that data and then plug it into the equation? So that's something that we recognize as an active question, and we're looking to inform that further over the summer.
And just out of curiosity, this is not a budget committee, but how many people does it take to do all this for this many thousand lakes?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, fortunately, we have a lot of monitoring that's actually happening in Minnesota because of the work that's being done under the Clean Water Fund. So we have staff and staffing that are going out to a number of sites every year in order to do that monitoring. We're looking at how could we integrate the monitoring that's needed to understand the carbon and the iron into that already occurring effort to really minimize the cost. So then the cost would be more just the cost of actually analyzing the samples, which are actually pretty inexpensive. These are pretty standard analyses, so it's not super expensive laboratory costs that we need to incur in order to get the information we need.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just sort of curious related to how, for instance, a city that has a wastewater treatment plant, would they be looking at this data to determine what their effluent is and if it meets standards?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, certainly any discharger we would want that is discharging to a wild rice water, we would want to evaluate the amount of sulfate that's in their discharge as well as take those samples of iron and organic carbon within the sediment in those downstream waters in order to figure out if an effluent limitation for their permit is appropriate. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Say, in the testimony, you mentioned that there was a process for adding lakes and streams to the list. Can you explain that a little further? Why wouldn't you list them right away, or what would happen to trigger to a lake or stream to be added to the list?
Sure, Chairman and Senator Coleman, we are proposing to add as many waters that meet the definition through rulemaking when we start rulemaking this fall. So going through the first rulemaking, at the end of that, we would have a list of 1,300-plus waters that we would know for certain are wild rice waters and subject to the standard going forward. We recognize that over time, that additional information will come forward to demonstrate that there are other waters in the state that meet this, for instance, 8,000 stems in a lake or 800 stems in a river mile. And we need to be mindful of the fact that we need to add those through an administrative process going forward. What type of documentation would be needed to demonstrate that a a given water body needed would warrant being added to that list is something that we're continuing to talk about. Certainly, you know, information about harvesting or surveys are fabulous, but we also recognize that other types of information may be needed to be considered as well.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Eaton, then Senator Huffman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you
contacting the EPA to get their feedback on how they view the science behind this new approach?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we are very much in communication with the EPA. They have participated as in our advisory committee meetings in development of this draft proposal all the way up through now, and we'll continue to involve them and communicate with them so they understand that what we're doing and what we're proposing. And ultimately, once this goes through the administrative rules process here in Minnesota under the Clean Water Act, the EPA has the authority and the responsibility to approve any of our water quality standards in the state.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I had was, how will you or have you worked with the tribes at all on this project?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have members of a couple of tribes that are participating on our advisory committee, the technical staff there. There's also, they've been participating in the development of this process all along. We would continue to look to the advisory committee to inform our work as we continue to move forward. But then there's a separate thing we want to do it that's called a consultation. That's a government-to-government relationship that we want to make sure that we honor that as a part of this process too. So when we're at the point of having a draft rule developed, before we put that on public notice, we would have conversations with various tribal governments to get their feedback and input.
Thank you.
Senator Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have four sets of questions, and so you talked about the formal rulemaking of the EPA summer fall of 2015. Have you buttoned down the dates? Is the first part of that, and then the second part is where is that going to be held, and how much you'd have to follow the rules on notification and stuff. But have you gotten those dates down, and where is that going to be?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in terms of formal rulemaking under the State's Administrative Procedures Act, we will initiate that rulemaking in late summer, early fall. We then anticipate that there will be a number of different public hearings and meetings that will take place. We'll be taking public comment on the rule package, and I would imagine that as other rulemakings that we've done, we either meet in various locations throughout the state or make webcasts available so that people can go to one of our regional offices within the state and participate through that electronic means.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Huffman.
So if I was sitting at home in Champlin, Minnesota, and I didn't understand the Administrative Procedures Act, I could go to where to find out where that information is going to be and where I could show up or not show up?
Mr. Chair and Senators, we actually have a couple of different ways that people can get that information. First of all, we maintain an extensive rulemaking docket on our website, and we have an email list that people can sign up for if they want to get updates on that. We also have a separate email list about the wild rice sulfate standard study and updates about that. So folks can go onto our website, click a couple of different things, and get signed up to get regular information. Also, then, when we do have an administrative hearing, we go through a public notice process that involves putting things on our website, putting it in the state register, which I know not your average person in Champlin isn't going to necessarily read, but we also often do news releases to get the word out about it, too. So we try to do our best to get the word out, but we're always welcome to other ideas.
Yeah. Point of clarification, we're above average intelligence in
Champlin. I used to live in Champlin, so
thank
I agree
you.
With you.
I know. So, Senator Marty, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of other things on timelines, and one is Thank you, Senator Eaton, for doing the EPA input final rule. The question there is the authority and responsibility to approve. Do they have a timeline that they have to follow, and are they consistent with the timelines to follow? Because, you know, you could be waiting a lifetime for some responses from the federal agency. So can you talk about that? And then as long as you're on timelines, roll that into, you know, with the tribe, the government-to-government consultation relationship, also expectation of timelines there. What I'm trying to see is a vision of okay, we have a rulemaking procedure, but then you have these other entities in there, and what's the timeline, and when is this going to happen? And you're shaking your head, so I'll be quiet and listen.
Mr. Chair and Senators, we anticipate that this rulemaking ultimately will probably take about 2 years, just because of the necessary steps that are laid out within the administrative procedures process itself. We also anticipate that there will be requests for contested case hearings, so that would be a proceeding, a formal legal proceeding that would take place in front of an administrative law judge. They prepare a report. They make a recommendation to the agency, then that report and recommendation would go to our Citizens Board for their consideration. And once the Citizens Board, should they adopt the rule and find the rule to be needed and reasonable and meet all of the requirements of rulemaking, that rule would then be adopted by the state of Minnesota. Then it moves to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for their review and approval. Mr. Chair and Senator Hoffman, the timeline for that is they have 60 to 90 days to either review and approve or review and essentially deny or send back for additional work.
Senator Marty, thank you. Mr. Chair, this leads to my real question is, so the timelines and examples are happening. So does anything change if nothing happens between now and the 2 years? Does current standard, current law, current best practice, is that what is established and maintains itself between now and 2 years from now?
Ms. Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a water quality standard that is currently a part of our water quality standard, so we will have to figure out through the permitting process how we deal with that.
Senator Marty,
Mr.
Chair, the process piece always scares me. What, when you talk about process, is there a timeline associated with process? And I'm not trying to be, when we look at process, I sit on Health and Human Services, and there's lots of processes in place, and there's no intended outcome, and I like to talk about outcomes a lot. And I don't mean that tongue-in-cheek, but I really, if we're going through a state of processes, how much time is involved in here and what's it? So if you have another process you have to do, is that a whole new set of timelines, or is that, I mean, just help me understand that piece, and then I'll let the we'll continue on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, if I'm understanding your question, it sounds like you want to have an idea of when we start rulemaking and when that will be complete and that will be implementing what the new standard is, and I believe I said we anticipate that taking about a 2 year time frame. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, just to follow, and that would be the same then with your, when you talked about your water quality standard that will possibly be discussed and then have a process, is that going to be the same type of a 2 year period as well?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, during this interim 2 year time period between now or when we propose the rule and when the rule is finally adopted, we know that people are going to be interested in how we address permitting and dealing with wastewater discharges during that interim time period, and that's something that we're working on to address right now. It's untested ground for us, and we're looking at how we address that through in this interim 2 year time frame. So it's not an additional time period added on to the 2 years. We're looking at how to address the current standard in this existing interim period.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Flood, finally, because it does relate to the bill we're taking up in a minute, 2 years from this fall, you're saying, so in this fall 2017, you would expect to have whatever rule in place?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is what we anticipate.
Thank you. Any final questions for Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 1007. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for sticking around on this Friday before the break, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill. Mr. Chairman, Senator, and committee members, the Senate File 1007 is in front of the committee and has been introduced for a few reasons. And one of the reasons was because the sulfate wild rice rule that was promulgated in 1973 has suddenly become an issue in permitting in virtually all of our big industries up in northern Minnesota, as well as it could come to fruition in many of our wastewater treatment plants, provided the rule is applied to all water permits. And it could cost billions of taxpayers' dollars in order to convert wastewater treatment plants to the 10 standard, as well as it could cost hundreds of millions of dollars for mining companies, any other big industry that might have a large discharge to convert their discharges, and it could ultimately put some companies out of business. So since 1973, when the standard was implemented based on some 1940s experiments that I don't know if they're good experiments or not, But in some of the hearsay that I've heard about it is pretty interesting. That when asked of the scientist what should the standard be, he said 10 sounds like a good number. And a few days later, he was called up and he said maybe it should be 50. Well, 10's in rule. And what happened is that all through the history of the sulfate standard being in rule since 1973, it very seldom ever got applied to any permit, and I think it may have only been applied to one. With the advent of PolyMet coming along, suddenly it was brought to the PCA's attention, and in 2009, PCA decided that it was now part of the permitting process that they hadn't done for many, many years. So as a result, we have been experiencing some very serious threats to the mining industry. If any of you have been paying attention to what has been going on in the world market of mines and iron ore, U.S. Steel has just announced that not only are they going to idle Keetac and lay off 412 employees, but their nationwide plants, they have announced layoffs of up to almost 5,000 employees. They've idled 5 of their 11 steel mills, and nationwide, out of the 20 steel mills that we have, 11 of them are planned to be idle. And now that's not directly related to the sulfate. It's directly related to steel dumping in the United States coming in from overseas, and it's directly related to the price of oil, and it's directly related to the price of iron ore. But at the same time, this is another chink in the armor. And so in 2011, because of this threat and because of what has been going on in the permitting process, we passed a law that is what you just saw PCA present. And the law basically said that they should do experiments. We give them $1.5 million and get some science and come up with some conclusions about what the standard for wild rice should be. And at the same time, it was our intent, and we believe that the law says it is the law, that no other permits will be issued during the time that the PCA is promulgating rules and has designated waters. Since the PCA has not interpreted the law that way, we put another bill in to make it clear that our intent for the particular 2011 law was that no permits would be issued during the time that rules are being promulgated. So what you have in front of you is that particular rule. And Mr. Chairman, so I've been working with the PCA, with the industry, and I think that we're all trying to get to the same place. and I think we're all trying to get to the point where we have a standard that everybody can live with. We have a standard that makes sense. We have a standard that's based on the science. And to move this along just a little bit, Mr. Chairman, I would like to do an author's amendment, an A2 amendment. I think you have an A2 amendment, just to put the bill in the form that I would like it to be in. And I'm seriously concerned, Mr. Chairman, that if the 10 standard does get applied and is put in, is what comes out of the rulemaking, that we will be shutting down the industry. Now, it's my understanding from what I've had discussions with the PCA that this 10 standard, for their purposes of promulgating the rule, is something that they think should be changed. And they think it could be appropriate in certain instances, and they think it's probably not at all appropriate in other instances. And as you heard them say, in the instances where there is iron in the water, the sulfate does not convert to sulfite and does not affect the wild rice. In Dr. Pastor's conclusions of his experiments from the experiments that he just did, his own conclusion was that up to concentrations of 1,600 that of sulfate, that it didn't appear to harm the wild rice. And in the Chamber of Commerce's scientific study, their conclusions were up to as high as 2,500. It did not harm the wild rice. And so I think what we're seeing is that we have a standard in place that needs to be modified. We have a standard in place that needs to be dealt with, and we have a process in place that needs to be followed, and we shouldn't be implementing 10 standards while we're in the process of getting new rules. And so while the A2 amendment, Mr. Chairman, I don't know, is I don't think it's a be-all or should it be maybe considered to be the bill. I want it to be what we're working off of, because I think it has the intent that I think I want to see, and I think the agency wants to see, and I think people would like to see. And so, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would just like to have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment, to be the bill.
Senator Hoffman moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. And so, Mr. Chairman, since I pointed out that this is a work in progress, and since I know there's a real lot of people here that have come to testify on this bill, and I know there's both the pros and cons on the bill, I think there's work to be done yet, and I really don't want committee members to have to take votes on something that isn't ready for prime time. And so I don't know if you would still like to hear the testimony. I would kind of like to hear the testimony, Mr. Chairman. It would be my intent, though, to lay the bill over if you would so do at the end of the hearing, Mr. Chairman, because I think that we're getting somewhere with this particular language, and I think that people are close to agreeing that this is something that we want to see happen. And so that would be my intent, Mr. Chairman, to lay the bill over at the end of the hearing. And so I guess it's up to you to whether or not you want to hear testimony from the people that are...
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, excuse me. Yes, we will hear the testimony. It's your decision about laying the bill over. I think we have plenty of people here who are ready to testify with concerns or support or whatever for the legislation, and I think we should go ahead with that. And I think my staff has indicated to both sides that we'd like to limit the total to each side to about 45 minutes. And with that, I'll ask if any members of the committee have any questions for Senator Tomasoni before that point. If not, go ahead and have your witnesses begin coming up.
Whoever wants to come up. Who do you have on the list there, Mr. Chairman?
We have Kurt Anderson, Tony Quillis, Mike Henslow are the first three. And go ahead in any order that you wish. Please identify yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kurt Anderson. I'm the manager of environmental and land management for Minnesota Power. My background is in water quality management and aquatic toxicology, including toxicity experiments with wild rice. I have extensive experience evaluating and implementing both the Federal Clean Water Act and Minnesota water quality rules. As a professional water scientist, I'm committed to sound science and a fully established regulatory process. I'm pleased to be with you today to share my perspectives about this legislation and why its passage is so important to the state of Minnesota. To begin, I just want to be perfectly clear that this bill does not weaken protections for wild rice. Instead, the proposal simply ensures that the sulfate standard and the waters to which it applies undergo the appropriate rulemaking before cities, industries, and other dischargers are forced to expend funds to meet the existing 10 milligram per liter standard, which recent research has shown to be imprecise and which the MPCA has announced will soon be adjusted. I also think it's important to touch a bit more on the history of the existing 10 milligram per liter standard, and I want to take a few minutes to go through that. So in the 1930s and 1940s, as we heard, Dr. Moyle conducted a series of field observations throughout Minnesota, collecting data on wild rice and sulfate levels. This research took place from the prairies of southwestern Minnesota, where many salts, and including but not limited to sulfate, are naturally high. Sulfate does not exist in a vacuum. If sulfate is high, so are many other salts and minerals. And that research also went into northeastern Minnesota, where many of these salts are naturally low. Based on this fairly basic research, Dr. Moyle concluded a link between low sulfate and higher rice abundance. He did not, however, examine other factors that are extremely important to the abundance of wild rice, such as water fluctuations and flow, different soils, competing species, land use practices, weather, all of which are markedly different as one moves from the prairie regions to the northeastern boreal forests. As we all know, there are many, many differences in plants and animals between these areas of the state, and yet currently wild rice is the only species currently linked to sulfate. Based on this research, Dr. Moyle concluded, as we heard, that rice is generally absent when sulfate levels exceed about 50 milligrams per liter, and that no large stands of rice occurred in water with more than 10 milligrams per liter. However, the key word here is generally. Dr. Moyle himself noted that wild rice was observed growing in waters containing over 250 milligrams per liter of sulfate, 25 times the current standard. Research conducted by other scientists, including university scientists in the 1960s and 70s, showed that sulfate's effect on wild rice might range from 60 all the way up to 500 milligrams per liter. In fact, in 1968, the University of Saskatchewan found wild rice growing well in lake sediments that had 1,500 milligrams per liter of sulfate, or 150 times the current standard. Sulfate's non-toxicity to wild rice has since been confirmed by recent research. In simple terms, it is now abundantly clear that sulfate itself is not toxic to wild rice until levels reach over 1,000 parts per million. However, despite the uncertainty around the specific sulfate number back in the 1970s, Minnesota did adopt the 10 milligram per liter standard. In 1975, the first attempt to apply that standard took place at the Boswell Energy Center in Cohasset, Minnesota, which is a Minnesota Power-owned facility. However, after administrative hearings from wild rice experts, the sulfate standard was adjusted to 40 milligrams per liter during the sensitive time frame, April to June, and 60 milligrams per liter for the rest of the year. Until 2010, no other Minnesota permits contained sulfate limits to protect wild rice. And MPCA staff themselves, as late as 2009, indicated they thought the standard had little scientific basis and would be revised. However, due to permitting actions seeking to apply the standard, the Minnesota legislature passed a law in 2011 requiring that the PCA establish criteria for designating wild rice waters subject to the standard before it was applied. This law required the PCA consult with the DNR, Minnesota Indian Tribes, and other interested parties, such as municipal and industrial wastewater dischargers, before designating any waters as wild rice waters. At this time, however, the full public notice and comment requirements of the law have not been fulfilled, and accordingly, no waters can legally be designated as wild rice waters. This legislation simply seeks to ensure that this critical rulemaking process takes place, protecting cities and industries across the state, and this is not just a mining issue and this is not just a northeastern Minnesota issue, but cities and industries across the state from undertaking unneeded and expensive regulation. There is certainly much at stake with the designation of wild rice waters in Minnesota, and it's not all about costs. For the protection of the resource, for the protection of wild rice, it is essential to clearly identify, following solid scientific criteria and a formal public notice and input process, which waters are truly wild rice waters, including the times of the year that the rice might be vulnerable. But if we do get this wrong, and waters are inappropriately or hastily designated, there could be highly impactful economic consequences and potentially no commensurate benefit to wild rice. Those economic impacts should not be underestimated. Sulfite removal is not like conventional wastewater treatment systems. Instead, sulfite removal to 10 parts per million or less requires extremely intensive treatment, typically reserved for drinking water systems. Those systems are expensive to install and maintain, potentially costing millions of dollars for even a small municipal wastewater treatment plant. If the state were to enforce 10 milligram per liter standard now, before the rulemaking process, the most likely treatment option for discharge would be a membrane system, what we call a reverse osmosis system. It can produce wastewater with less than 10 parts per million sulfate. However, only a percentage of the water can be discharged through this membrane. A portion of it, sometimes up to 40% or even more, stays behind the membrane and is even higher in salts and minerals, and that needs to be disposed of. And you can't discharge that water to the river. You have to treat it, either by concentrating it into a brine or evaporating it. Treatment of this concentrate can cause the cost to increase substantially. For example, for a typical municipal wastewater plant discharging, say, 2,000 gallons per minute, we could look at $20 million in capital expenditures and several million dollars more every year in operations and maintenance. Not surprisingly, there are currently no reverse osmosis treatment systems operating to treat municipal wastewater in the state of Minnesota. In closing, this bill simply confirms and reestablishes what the 2011 law pertaining to wild rice water quality standards already requires and is wholly consistent with the historic approach to setting such standards in our state. The potential ramifications of enforcing the standard before the rulemaking can proceed are enormous, and we need to ensure that all stakeholders are represented in the setting of water quality standards and designations related to wild rice. Thank you for your interest in protecting our state's aquatic resources and for your time today. I'm happy to answer any of the questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Quillis, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I will be brief before I turn it over to Mr. Hansel. Mr. Chairman, but I wanted to draw your attention to why this is such an important issue to the Chamber of Commerce and the business community. In your folders, I hope, is a map that looks like this. And that is a map that came at the request of the Chamber of Commerce to Bar Engineering to take the 2008 DNR Waters report that listed the acreage, estimated acreage of natural rice stands in the state of Minnesota. And then we asked them to take the NPDES permits in the state of Minnesota and overlay them on that map. On that map, on the bottom left-hand side, you will see that there are 673 facilities if you end up adding those all together. And they range from agricultural processing, as you can see, there's 40 of those, industrial 232, the Department of Natural Resources at 8 cities that Mr. Anderson has just referenced, there's 385 of those, and tribal communities at 8. That map shows why that's so important to the business community. Sometimes this issue has been referenced, as Mr. Anderson pointed out, to just one industry or just northern Minnesota. This issue is impacting statewide, and I want to make that abundantly clear as to why we're involved in this issue, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to go through, and we are directly impacted either through our facilities and our members having these NPDES permits. And if not, we discharge into one of those 385 municipalities. So that's how we're either directly or indirectly impacted. Mr. Anderson also touched on the cost to comply. It's millions of dollars in capital costs and then operation and maintenance costs on the ongoing year, outgoing years are also millions of dollars. And we're worried that could threaten future economic development projects and capital investment in this state. Madam Chair, you heard the Pollution Control Agency talk about how they're going to start a rulemaking process, and we look forward to working with them and other stakeholders, and we just want to make sure that all information from all stakeholders are involved in that rulemaking process and make sure that it's science-based, Mr. Chairman. With that, I'd stand for any questions and turn it over to Mr. Hansel.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mike Hansel. I'm a senior chemical engineer and vice president at Barr Engineering Company. I've been involved in environmental engineering for over 40 years and have been involved with the MPCA and the advisory committee on this process for the past 3 or 4 years. I want to expand a little bit on what Mr. Anderson and Mr. Quillis said about the costs of treating it. This will be a large cost. Based on the PCA's recent proposed approach, they've listed 1,300 waters that they think should be designated as wild rice waters. Those waters include the lower St. Louis and the lower Mississippi River. If those waters are truly listed as wild rice waters and subject to a sulfate standard, this could impact 3/4 of the dischargers of the state of Minnesota. And most of those will be impacted. To date, the PCA has asked only about 150 dischargers to measure for sulfate in their discharge. 96% of them have had sulfates higher than 10 milligrams per liter, and so they will require treatment. As Mr. Anderson said, removing sulfate down to 10 milligrams per liter is very difficult. It requires membrane treatment. This membrane treatment has not been used for wastewater treatment in Minnesota or very few other places. It's been used for drinking water. In fact, you may have read in the paper where there's a large multi-billion dollar operation set up to provide drinking water to Southern California from seawater. Most of the operations throughout the world that use this technology do exactly that. They convert seawater or brackish water into fresh water for drinking. It's very easy for them to dispose of this brine water that's left over from the treatment by simply putting it back into the ocean from which it came. Minnesota doesn't have that option. We don't have an ocean. We can't evaporate it like they can in Arizona or Mexico. But instead, we have to treat it, and in most cases, that will involve evaporating the water off and producing a salt cake. At the request of the chamber, we looked at the costs for a city discharging 2,000 gallons a minute, about 3 million gallons a day. That'd be a city somewhere between 12 and 15,000 people. The costs are as follows. Capital cost for such a system would be on the order of $19 million. Annual operating costs could range from $3 to $6 million, depending upon the type of methods and how much pretreatment do they use. The additional cost per household would be $21 to $32 a month, or $250 to $380 per year, a substantial imposition, particularly on rural Minnesota. Industry faces higher costs as well. Typically, industry flows are much higher than municipal flows, and their sulfate content tends to be higher, although not always. We also have estimated costs for some of our clients with flows of 7,000 gallons per minute. Capital cost would be on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars, and operation and maintenance costs would be tens of millions of dollars. While some industries have indicated they intend to employ these technologies, and while costs may decrease a little bit as additional experience is gained, before the PCA requires any city or industry to invest tens of millions of dollars in capital costs and millions of dollars a year going forward in operation and maintenance costs, I think they deserve to know and they need to know exactly what the standard will be and where that standard applies, and to know that that standard will actually protect wild rice. The only way to have those assurances is for the MPCA to complete the rulemaking, which they've begun, and to take into account the imposition of any standards during the intervening time. Prior to that time, the agency should not ask any city or industry to make such a large financial commitment. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hensel. Questions? Thank you all. The next couple I have is Chris Breland, David Lyogard, and Mike Long.
Good Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing my input in this very important issue. Senator Tomasoni and I were on opposite sides about 15 years ago. My son was a goalie from Mesabi East, and his son was a wing. That's the only issue we've ever differed on is when our boys were on opposite teams, and they ended up being friends after that. So otherwise, I'm with Senator Tomasoni.
And, sir, you're Mr. Vreeland?
Chris Vreeland, yes.
Yeah, welcome. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Minnesota cities are committed to good wastewater treatment. I worked for the City of Aurora for 33 years in water, wastewater, and public works. I know firsthand the costs associated with wastewater operations. In 2008, the City of Aurora started a wastewater plant upgrade to meet current standards at a cost of $7 million. The cost to households was an increase of $20 per month. To meet the sulfate standard, an additional $30 per month per household would be required. I am currently a City of White Lakes Council member involved in our wastewater plant upgrade. We're a population 2,000. We are meeting with the MPCA right now at an upgrade of $5 million to our plant. New permits require, in 5 years, a mercury standard of $1.5 to $4 million. Now a sulfate standard, $3 to $5 million. Our yearly operating budget for the city is $4 million. You're talking in the next 8 years, we could spend $12 million on our wastewater plant, and this standard is not needed. Where will the money come from? Every dollar that we spend on wastewater treatment is a dollar not available for other infrastructure, public safety, and economic development. Again, we are committed to good wastewater treatment and clean water. We take that very seriously. We do expect that the standards that we are required to meet are backed by valid scientific evidence. I've been following the sulfate issue for several years, and the evidence to support a 10 part per million standard is not there. We strongly support Senator Tomasoni's House File 1007 requiring the MPCA to designate the waters for wild rice. We also want to be active participants in the process of designating those waters and be made part of the rule so we know where the standard applies. In closing, I have a couple questions for you. Have you ever heard of a wild rice shortage? I haven't. I live up there, I rice. I've never heard of a shortage. Who's going to pay for it? This is major money for us small cities. You know what the EPA safe drinking water standard is for sulfate? See this bottle of water in front of me? It's 250 parts per million, and that's a recommendation. I could drink this. And actually, they say I can drink it up to 1,000 parts per million of water. That is the EPA safe drinking water standard. How many states have a sulfate standard at all? One, Minnesota. These are some interesting questions. I'd like to thank the MPCA. I think they've done an excellent job here today, and I think we're on the right road here. I think we're looking for common sense as it comes from small cities, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vreeland. Mr. Lauger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Lislegard, and today I'll be wearing several different hats. First and foremost, as a husband and a father who knows that I gain nothing directly by being here, but I stand to lose everything by not. As a former steelworker who lost his job due to a plant closure over 14 years ago, as a councilman for the City of Aurora, a community still struggling from the LTV plant closure, and finally as an employee of Lakehead Constructors, a major supplier vendor to large industrial companies across northeast Minnesota, mining being at the top of the list. The bill before you today plays a key role in making sure that the impact of sulfate standards where I live does not destroy the mining industry. We have been following the sulfate issue very closely, and we understand that the handling of this regulation is one of the major challenges facing our region. And I said one of the challenges, because we also understand that mining in particular, the lifeblood of our communities, is currently being threatened on many different fronts. But here today, the threat is the sulfate standard, and whether this state is going to have regulations that destroy the economy where I live instead of providing sensible protection to the environment. The sulfate threat is on the doorstep of hundreds of small cities and businesses across this state. If enforced, the current sulfate standard of 10 parts per million will be devastating to these cities and industries, well beyond the Minnesota Iron Range. It has been recently suggested by the Star Tribune editorial board that the state should financially help or carve out small cities affected by the sulfate standard due to the high cost of compliance. They're right. The cities can't afford this regulation. But as a councilman of one of these small cities, I can tell you with no hesitation that it won't matter whether you help us financially or carve us out, because of mining, the main economic engine of our region, fails. So does our communities. Please remember, the same people living in northeast Minnesota communities, either directly or indirectly, work in and around mining. You kill mining, and you kill our economy. In closing, I will say, we are very proud of what we do in the mining industry. We care deeply about our communities, and we care of our natural environment. All we want is a common sense and a balance with sulfate regulation, in which this bill helps to create. I want to thank you, Senator Tomasoni, for standing with us over the years since the closure, and I ask you to support Senator Tomasoni's bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lisselgard. Mike Long.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Michael Long, and I'm Director of Environmental Affairs for Cliffs Natural Resources. By way of background, Cliffs has a major presence in the iron ore range where our company operates United Taconite, North Shore Mining, and Hibbing Taconite. Together, these facilities can produce up to 19.5 million tons of taconite iron ore pellets annually and employ over 1,800 people with total economic impact to the region of nearly $900 million. In my testimony today, I will outline why Senate File 1007 is necessary to ensure that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency follows the process for promulgating a water quality standard that is supported by federal and state statute. And second, I will highlight the status of the developing science to more accurately establish a water quality standard that is protective of wild rice. Let me begin with the process of promulgating a water quality standard. The Clean Water Act prescribes an approach to developing water quality standards that I liken to three legs of a stool. And without all three legs, the stool, or the 10 milligram per liter limit, cannot stand. The first leg of the stool requires an agency to identify the specific beneficial use which is meant to be protected in water. That's under 40 CFR 131.10, subparagraph A. In the case of wild rice production, the MPCA established the use, but the term wild rice production is not well defined in current rule. It lacks specificity as to the types of water bodies in which the wild rice grows and the quantities in which it must grow in order for the water to be designated. The second leg of this stool requires the agency to develop specific numeric criteria using sound scientific rationale to protect the use. While Minnesota rules currently include a 10 milligram per liter limit to protect wild rice growth, this numeric criterion is not supported by contemporary research methods. I reference you to 40 CFR 131.11. And while MPCA recently proposed a new methodology for implementing a site-specific sulfate standard, additional steps must be taken, to ensure the standard is grounded in sound science. The third leg, and the reason Senate File 1007 is so important, is that the agency must designate the specific waters in which the use is to be protected. I reference 40 CFR 131.2. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has yet to designate wild rice waters through rulemaking, and thus, this stool, with no legs, cannot stand. In fact, without these three legs, without meeting these requirements, the 10 milligram per liter limit does not meet the definition of a water quality standard. Allow me to reemphasize that point. The current 10 milligram per liter does not and should not have force, since MPCA has not undertaken the necessary steps to give it efficacy as a water quality standard. While the MPC has taken strides this past week by issuing a proposal that outlines how each of these three legs might be addressed in the rule, MPCA has estimated it will take approximately another 2 years to complete the rulemaking administrative process. Until rulemaking is complete, in the interim, it is critical that Senate File 1007 provide businesses certainty that the old limit would not be applied until MPCA designates the water subject to the rule, while MPCA develops a more scientifically based water quality standard following the administrative process under the Clean Water Act. I would now like to briefly address the numeric criterion that's being contemplated to protect wild rice. In recent years, publicly funded research and independently funded research examined the relationship between sulfate and wild rice. Both studies point towards similar conclusions. First, sulfate in of itself is not toxic to wild rice until sulfate concentrations exceed 1,600 milligrams per liter. Second, sulfate may impact wild rice by way of a very complex conversion to sulfide when iron is not present in the root zone. We acknowledge MPCA's recent draft recommendation to reconsider the imprecise 10 milligram per liter sulfate numeric limit and move towards a site-specific approach. However, the scientific research to understand the fate of sulfate transformation to sulfide is much more complex and thus far incomplete. We are concerned that MPCA's use of the sulfate science developed thus far to predict the generation of sulfide at concentrations that are toxic to wild rice will lead to yet another unscientific outcome. Thus, we hope MPCA's pending rulemaking process will take into consideration new sulfide science coming forward that will address the shortcomings identified last fall by the peer review panel. In closing, I urge you to keep in mind Governor Dayton's comments this week that indicated the importance of getting this issue right. He noted, and I quote, "If you have an impossibility low standard that doesn't correlate the problem that you're trying to solve anyway, you put the whole industry out of business. We don't even know if it's going to improve wild rice conditions, and it's going to be catastrophic for life up in northeast Minnesota," end quote. This legislation will provide permittees certainty on how MPCA will administer the existing sulfate criteria until a scientifically based standard is developed for a transparent public rulemaking process. And this legislation does not preclude MPCA from continuing to work with permittees to minimize sulfide discharges until a new standard is developed. We greatly appreciate the support of Senator Tomasoni and other sponsors of Senate File 1007. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you,
Mr. Long. Mr. Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the two city council members, and I just want to up front say I spent 11 years as a city council member, so I'm very familiar where you sit. I was watching on TV. I was distracted before I got here. I just want to clarify something. What you're asking for as city council members, as elected officials, is to allow the PCA to do the job that they're supposed to do according to rules that are already existing in statute. That could be for Senator Tomasoni, too. I'm just trying to get my head around where we're going here, that all you're asking for is to follow the laws we've already got on the books in this process. Is that what I'm hearing?
Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Osmick, I'm not going to put words in their mouth, but what we're trying to do here is to make sure that the 2011 law is followed, which the PCA has started on, but at the same time that that while they're going through the rulemaking process, that they do not issue any permits with the 10 standard in it, because I think we have had ample testimony and ample scientific evidence that the 10 standard is not an accurate number and that there needs to be a new rule. And so that's what they're testifying to.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to answer that too. Mr. Chair, committee members, I think that's exactly what we're talking about. Don't enforce the 10 standard until all the evidence is done. I mean, the city of Hoyt Lakes doesn't want to go spend $2 or $3 million putting in a sulfate removal system and 2 years later find out, oh, geez, sorry, you didn't need it. Well, I'm sure we're not going to get our money back. So I think that's basically what we're looking at.
And maybe as long as we brought up the Hoyt Lake system, they have a brand new wastewater treatment plant. Aurora does. I get them mixed up all the time. I'm a Chisholm guy. And they are emitting with a brand new plant and the latest technology. They are emitting over 80 parts per million, and so they would have to redo a brand new plant again in order to get down to 10. And that would be the case with almost all these wastewater treatment plants across the state.
And that's $7.5 million upgrade, and we still don't meet the standards.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, at least my understanding is, as this law for 10 parts per million has been in place since 1973, and the expectation for the last 40-some years has been that you're following it, and in fact, in December of 2012, the State Court of Appeals upheld that you were to continue to follow it because of the Federal Clean Water Act.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Eaton, that's not very accurate because even though it's been in rule for the last, since 1973, it's never been applied to permits until 2009. And as you heard, there was only one other permit that was applied to. It's now has been applied to the KeyTech permit and needs to be complied with. We don't know for sure if the KeyTech expansion was discontinued because of their inability to comply with the permit. But the place not only did not do the expansion, they are now talking about laying 412 people off and idling the plant, and we're very concerned about whether or not it reopens.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Senator Tomasoni, I don't want people out of work. I mean, that's definitely not my goal. I've presented a lot of jobs bills, but I would like to point out there are jobs in environmental cleanup, and my understanding is that there's a substantial environmental fund in the IRRRB. I would assume that that's what it's for. The other piece is I didn't know that laws didn't count if you didn't follow them.
Senator Eaton, you're missing the point. The permits were never issued through the PCA. They were never required the standard to be followed. And the point is that since 1973, the standard was never in any of the permits because it was not required by the PCA to follow the standard. And so, therefore, the mining companies weren't required to follow the standard. And what's happening now is all of a sudden they're saying, well, even though the wild rice is still growing and even though we never, ever complied with the standard before, and this is coming from the agency level, not from the mining company level. It was coming from the agency level that now all of a sudden it has to be complied with. And if we don't comply with it, my goodness, all the wild rice is going to go away. Well, the wild rice has been here since 1973 when we had the standard, and it wasn't ever applied to any permit, and we still have wild rice. And, in fact, last summer the wild rice grew in all the wrong conditions. It grew when the water was supposed to be high. It was low. And when the water was supposed to be low, it was high. But the wild rice grew anyway, and we had a bumper crop last summer. And so it's kind of like we're here arguing about something that hasn't made a difference, except now it's going to make a huge difference because it could shut down all of these mining companies because they won't be able to comply with these standards.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni, are you aware of Dr. John Pastor's work from the University of Minnesota Duluth? He was also part of that sulfide study in 2011, and his belief that this is scientifically indefensible to use such an equation without first verifying and validating it against experimental data and without validating against data from the lakes. He says this would never stand up to peer review.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Eaton, that's one of the reasons that the PCA is going out to rulemaking right now is to figure out what's the right way to go. But let me read to you Dr. Pastor's own conclusion of the experiment that he just finished through the University of Minnesota that was that we made them do in law for $1.5 million. And his conclusion is sulfate did not affect either seed germination or seedling growth other than a slight depression of root lengths at extremely high concentrations of 1,600 parts per million. So even in his own experiments, he knows that 10 is not the right number.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, were these the tests that were done in hydroponic labs?
I think they were, yeah.
So they weren't done in natural settings.
Well, that's where they found the sulfide, too, in the hydroponic labs, just so you know. They didn't find it in the natural settings. And the sulfide is what this is all morphed into a sulfide. standard instead of a sulfate standard, and that's what's really getting concerning, because we're not even finding that in the natural wild.
The next three witnesses we have are Patrick Bloom, Larry Sutherland, and Chris Mausantonio. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Bloom, and I serve as the Director of Government Relations for Cliffs Natural Resources. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you and to testify today. I'm actually here first and foremost in support of my colleague, Michael Long, who just delivered the formal testimony on behalf of Cliffs Natural Resources. However, I just wanted to take this opportunity to make one quick point with regard to some of the testimony you've heard today. The testifiers and professional water quality professionals from the MPCA did a very excellent job of describing how the agency intends to fully promulgate rules with respect to the wild rice water quality standard going forward, a process which most of the witnesses today have acknowledged will take 2+ years. In response, however, one of the members of the committee here today asked how the agency intends to handle implementation of the standard in individual permits until that rulemaking process is fully complete. In response, the professionals, the folks from the MPCA, indicated that the agency is still working on determining the approach for addressing that standard in permits in the interim. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, unfortunately, that answer does not provide a high degree of certainty for municipalities and businesses in this state that are looking to make investments and plan budgets over the next 2+ years, which is exactly, we believe, why the legislation offered by Senator Tomasoni and his co-sponsors is the proper way for the legislature to exercise some jurisdiction and oversight over how this standard will be administered in permits over the next 2 years until a new science-based standard can be fully and adequately promulgated through rule. So just wanted to make that point briefly. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Bloom. Mr. Sutherland.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Assembly Committee members. My name is Larry Sutherland. I'm the head of United States Steel Mining Solutions. With me today is Chris Mausantonio from our Government Affairs Department in Pittsburgh. A little bit about who we are and what we do. As the head of Mining Solutions for U.S. Steel, I manage the largest taconite facility in northern Minnesota, which is MinTac, at approximately 16 million tons of iron ore pellets annually, along with our Keetac facility, which is approximately 6 million tons annually of iron ore pellets. At United States Steel Corporation, headquartered in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we are an integrated steel producer with major production operations in the United States and Central Europe, with an annual raw steelmaking capacity of 24.4 million net tons of steel. The company manufactures a wide range of value-added steel sheet and tubular products for the automotive, appliance, container, industrial machinery, construction, oil and gas industries. Our Minnesota ore operations, consisting of MinTac and Keetac in northeastern Minnesota, is the state's largest iron ore producer. Iron ore is the key ingredient in blast furnace-based steelmaking. 2013 economic impact of U.S. Steel Minnesota ore operations. I will read a little bit about what that includes as an economic footprint here in Minnesota, not only in northeastern Minnesota. We employ over 1,900 people at our mining facilities. These are high-quality, well-paying, family-sustaining jobs. Our iron ore operations also create thousands of other jobs that help our communities and other companies. For each job that we employ in our operations, it creates another 1.8 jobs in the economic sector. We have an annual payroll of over $170 million, health care benefits of approximately $30 million, $31 million in pension benefits, with an additional $6.4 million to the Steelworkers Pension Trust Fund. Active United States Steel retirees are approximately $1,600 that we pay for. We have an annual local tax base of $46.6 million, which beneficiaries are the Range School Districts and the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board, which also helps create jobs and promote business growth on Iron Range communities. We also do business with 456 vendors with an annual budget of over $621 million in business annually. We also provide $55 million per year in school trust land royalty payments, which is 94% of the total contributions to this fund for public education in Minnesota. U.S. Steel takes our responsibility to protect and preserve our environment very seriously. Environmental protection, along with safety compliance, is a core principle at United States Steel. Not only do we, as a company, take it seriously, our employees take it seriously as well. We not only work in that pristine area of the Iron Range, we raise our families there and we play there. 2015 will be a critical year for the future of iron mining in northeastern Minnesota. There are several issues with significant implications for the iron mining industry and the jobs it provides. Chief among those issues will be the application of the wild rice sulfate water quality standard. U.S. Steel believes the MPCA should adhere to the 2011 legislation and the Clean Water Act by designating waters through rulemaking prior to applying the standard. In addition to the procedural component, the research conducted by both the MPCA's research and that of the Minnesota Chamber needs to be considered to ensure sound science is used in future rulemaking. We are particularly concerned that KeyTAC has the only nepetes permit with a 10 milligram per liter standard applied and potentially could have the second permit when the draft MinTAC tailings nepetes permit is placed on public notice. Designation of waters would be conducted through a formal rulemaking process which will allow for public participation and provide another opportunity to vet the sulfate wild rice science. In short, the legislature is taking the opportunity to ensure that the MPCA adheres to the procedure for promulgating a water quality standard outlined in the Clean Water Act by requiring that the agency designate wild rice waters prior to enforcing a sulfate water quality standard. This is a critical issue this legislative session. Treating to the existing standard has the potential to cost our business alone hundreds of millions of dollars without providing commensurate environmental benefits. On behalf of United States Steel, I respectfully request the Senate Environment and Energy Committee support and approve Senate File 1007. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today.
Thank you, Mr. Sutherland. Mr. Massantonio, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no additional testimony at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Sutherland, and thanks for your testimony. I was wondering, with the closing of the KeyTAC mine and the laying off of 400 people, how will that affect? You had given us a figure, and I didn't write it down, of what your industry provides and what the type of money that the area gets from that. How what will the effect be from idling the KeyTAC from because of the Chinese dumping of steel or whatever is the reason for that?
The temporary idling of our KeyTAC facility to adjust pellet inventory levels at our corporate level because of the pullback of our operations due to unfairly traded and dumped steel onto our shores here in the United States is a huge impact to our corporation. Our CEO, Mario Longhi, testified in front of the Steel Caucus yesterday in Washington about that very effect and ramifications of what it's doing to our steel business across the United States, which in turn has impacted our KeyTAC facility with the idling, temporary idling, and layoff of up to 412 workers.
Senator Scalzi.
Mr. Chair, I guess I feel you know, I know that's an unfair situation that you've been handed, but I was just wondering, so is it about half of your operations? If you're idling KeyTac, you're keeping MinTac, and the two together have 1,900 employees. So I'm just wondering, will this decrease your revenues by half, or what percentage?
It could be extrapolated through the tonnage division of, we're approximately 6 million tons at KeyTac and 16 million at MinTac. So with that calculation would be the calculation that will impact taxes, our business footprint, and the economy up there. Yes.
Thank you all very much. Thank you. And we have testimony from Catherine Huffman and Steve Morse. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Catherine Hoffman. I'm a staff attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I was also a member of the Wild Rice Advisory Group that's been mentioned here a couple times today. MCA is an environmental nonprofit that uses law, science, and research to protect Minnesota's natural resources, wildlife, and the health of its people. We work on policies here at the state legislature. We participate in the work of state agencies, and when necessary, we also work in the courts. Among the environmental advocacy groups, MCA specializes in law, and that's partly what I'd like to talk to you about here today. But before I talk about that, I want to step back for a moment and ask the question, why does sulfate matter? Why are we here today talking about this chemical and these resources? Sulfate standards are important, not only because of wild rice, and I think there's broad agreement here today that wild rice is an important cultural resource, economic resource, spiritual resources for band members, but it's also about people and public health. Sulfate has a strong relationship to mercury in fish. It encourages a chemical reaction that allows mercury to convert into a form that allows fish to absorb it. Once the fish absorb it, people eat it, and that's how mercury gets into people. The Minnesota Department of Health did a study a couple years ago that found that 1 in 10 newborns on Minnesota's North Shore have unacceptably high levels of mercury in their blood. This is a neurotoxin that affects fetal development and a significant public health issue. Sulfate is also about other plants and animals besides wild rice. When sulfate is discharged into the water, mostly from wastewater treatment plants and mining operations, it settles into the sediment. And with the aid of bacteria, it becomes toxic, becomes sulfide. And it's toxic not only to wild rice, it affects other plants as well. A wide range of aquatic plants have trouble thriving in a high sulfate environment. So with that said, MCA opposes the proposed standards to the sulfate standard that were introduced by MPCA here today. PCA has proposed a formula that is scientifically questionable and difficult to implement. First, it's scientifically questionable. The scientist who conducted some of the studies on which this entire proposal is based called it scientifically indefensible. He said that water quality systems are too dynamic and change too much from season to season or year to year. In other words, you might calculate a formula once and get a sulfate standard, but if you did it again in a week or a month or a year, you may well get a different number. It's unreliable, and it's hard to know which standard is the right standard. And we'll never know, really, if PCA adopts this, except by waiting for 3 years or 5 years or 10 years and seeing whether or not we killed the wild rice. Second, it's time and resource intensive for the agency to implement a water quality standard on a case-by-case basis like this. It's not reasonable to ask the agency to invest the resources to go out and collect information about every single wild rice body so that we can apply the standard to it. And finally, it's vulnerable to manipulation. When these soil tests are taken, it's likely that there will be a wide range of results for the two inputs, iron and organic carbon. It allows permit holders to argue about what the water quality standard should be. You've written a water quality standard that's open to negotiation. That's not how the Clean Water Act should work, and it's not how we keep our waters clean in Minnesota. Our water should be kept clean, and it should not be open to negotiation. What's more, when it comes to the existing sulfate standard, our policy should be, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Water quality standards are written to protect clean water at all locations. So when determining the correct water quality standard, the agency shouldn't and doesn't pick a number that protects the clean water in some places but not others. They pick a value that protects it everywhere. Now, some places may be able to tolerate a higher level of a pollutant. This is true of many water quality standards, and it's probably true of sulfate and the existing number of 10 milligrams per liter. Nature is messy, and it's difficult to assign precise numerical values to some element in an ecosystem. So, when establishing a water quality standard, we choose a low or conservative number to ensure that we are protecting the maximum number of waters. But that doesn't mean that the water quality standard is wrong. In fact, if the 10 milligrams per liter is protective of most locations, which the research that PCA has conducted shows, that means it's correct. In sum, the PCA should not abandon the existing sulfate standard for a formula which is scientifically questionable and difficult to implement. The second topic I want to talk about is that MCA opposes Senate File 1007 because it is not consistent with the Clean Water Act and it allows pollution to continue unabated. First, this bill allows pollution to continue unabated. And this is true, by the way, of the amended version that we were given here today. Many taconite facilities have been operating for years in violation of the 10 milligrams per liter standard. So, for instance, U.S. Steel MinTac is discharging water at over 1,000 milligrams per liter, approximately 100 times the wild rice water quality standard. The two lakes right next to the facility once had wonderful wild rice crops, but now the wild rice harvest in those two lakes is extremely poor. This type of pollution will continue if our sulfate standard is not enforced. And just to demonstrate that, let me refer you to, in the amended version of Senate File 1007, A1, which indicates the agency shall ensure that no existing discharge further causes or contributes to sulfate impacts to wild rice. That further is a key word and very intentional in this legislation. The implication is that facilities should be allowed to continue business as usual at their discharge rates and that nothing will be done to require them to bring it down, even if it is 100 times the wild rice standard. Second, this bill conflicts with the Clean Water Act. Let me just talk for a moment about the Clean Water Act and how it's structured, because I think it's useful to understand. Many of our environmental laws use what's called cooperative federalism. This is where it's federal law, Congress implements it, but the states are given a role in enforcing it and implementing it. And that's the case for the Clean Water Act. So, pursuant to the Clean Water Act, which is federal law, Minnesota is one of the states that has been delegated, i.e., been given delegated authority from the Environmental Protection Agency to enforce the Clean Water Act within the state. But it's still federal law. So, under the Clean Water Act, even though the state has delegated authority, EPA maintains oversight. The state program has to meet federal requirements. And if the state program doesn't meet federal requirements, the EPA can object to and override individual Clean Water Act permits that are issued by the state or enforcement actions taken by the state. It can call for the state to implement corrective actions, i.e. change state law to be more consistent with federal law. Or it can withdraw the delegation entirely, and the EPA can step in and run the whole program, which means our program would be run from Chicago and not from St. Paul. The problem with this bill is that it takes an existing water quality standard, one that has been approved by the EPA and makes it so the agency cannot enforce it. It says the standard, it says that, I should refer to the language here, it says that the agency cannot require permittees to expend money for design or implementation of sulfate treatment technologies or other forms of sulfate mitigation. So maybe they can require them to do something, but nothing that costs money. And I'd be curious to hear more about what those options might be, but I'm not aware of any. The Clean Water Act, under federal law, requires the state to implement water quality standards as part of permitting. So it actually requires the state to enforce the sulfate standard as written at 10 milligrams per liter. And the EPA has already explained to the state that federal law does not allow what this bill proposes. In May 2011, Region 5, which is the Chicago office of the EPA, wrote a letter to the state legislature when a similar bill was proposed. And it said, a state with a federally authorized Clean Water Act program is required to issue permits that ensure the protection of federally approved water quality standards. And the EPA explained that if a state fails to abide by this requirement, it can object to a permit, and the state cannot issue that permit if the EPA has objected. The EPA can issue the permit themselves instead of the state, and the EPA can withdraw authorization for the state to enforce the Clean Water Act at all. In essence, this bill is basically asking the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to violate the Clean Water Act and federal law. And for all of these reasons, MCEA opposes the bill. Thank you. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Huffman. Mr. Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Morris. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We are a statewide coalition of environmental conservation groups, the largest in the state, representing 70 organizations and more than 400,000 Minnesotans. I had the pleasure of being before this committee yesterday with a much more pleasant task. We are tackling another rather intractable water quality issue, that dealing with agricultural runoff. And we are here with the agricultural interests talking about a proactive effort that we were putting forward with them to actually figure out how to solve the problem. Today, it's not quite as pleasant. And I want to start with a little bit of a history lesson, if I may. And it's about the Federal Clean Water Act. I can only underscore some of the points made by Ms. Huffman here. The Federal Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, and it's had a tremendous impact in our state, in our land of 10,000 lakes. As we know, we've had tremendous growth, economic growth, population growth since 1972, back in the days when I was in high school. Yet our water quality has improved tremendously, primarily because of the Clean Water Act's influence on facilities such as iron mines, such as cities, facilities that have a discharge that's kind of a pipe discharge, a point-type source of discharge. Through enforcement of the Clean Water Act by the state of Minnesota, we have made tremendous changes to our water over that time. We have seen that Minnesotans care about their lakes, rivers, and streams. We've invested many billions of dollars, to clean up our waters. And the proof is in the water. The water is cleaner today. Game fish that were nowhere to be found in the Mississippi River corridor a number of years ago have now returned. We can look at that corridor. We can look at the St. Louis River estuary up in the Lake Superior Basin with the way the fisheries have rebounded as we've cleaned up old industrial sites as well as wastewater discharges. This work was done by leaders who preceded us, previous leaders in our state, leaders of all political stripes from all corners of the state. It was done by working together to solve the pollution problems that we actually faced. It was done by not trying to undermine the Clean Water Act, but to figure out how we can work together to actually get the environmental outcomes we care about here in the state. In one instance, it was led by former governor and range governor Rudy Perpich. Back, Senator Marty, when you and I were just coming into the legislature in 1986, Rudy Perpich had negotiated. He was faced with the challenge of how do we clean up the Mississippi River south of the Twin Cities, where we're discharging billions and billions of gallons of raw sewage because the facilities could not handle the waste in water events. Wisconsin sued and said, we need to clean up our act. We need to follow the Clean Water Act. The governor and the state at that time did not try to undermine and argue that, well, you know, Lake Pepin settles out a lot of this stuff. It really treats it, and there are these natural systems. And, you know, down there where I live in Dakota, we don't really need to have the treatment occur up here because what the heck? We'll treat it some. He sat down with the other states and said, with Wisconsin, and said, how do we work this out? We got some federal money. We got some state money. We set up a time frame, a schedule. And over more than a decade, in hundreds of millions of dollars, we separated the raw sewage so that it no longer flows into the river. And we have a remarkable sport fishery occurring not just here in the Twin Cities but all the points south. The point is, the way to get to long-term solutions about some of these difficult problems is to think about how we can solve the problem, not to undermine the standard. As was stated, this bill is a threat and an undermining of the Federal Clean Water Act and our state authority. Ultimately, the approach in this bill falls short, and because of that, even with the amendments, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership avoids this because it is a rollback of current protections. It states that the agency may, in fact, not require expenditures for treatment facilities or other types of mitigation. That simply will not fly in Minnesota or with the federal government. Minnesota's regard for our lakes, rivers, and streams is legendary. This concern is always on the top list of environmental priorities for the public when we poll on environmental and conservation issues. This bill undercuts our established state standard that protects our waters. It is in conflict with the Clean Water Act. If enacted, it moves the state backwards on our efforts to protect our water for future generations. It's also, as Ms. Hoffman indicated, a very dangerous precedent. The bill undercuts the authority of the state's pollution control agency. A number of our member organizations in MEP have been highly critical of the MPCA in recent years, as the agency has let permits for taconite facilities lag for years and even decades. Yet, that's what's happening with agency discretion. Yet this bill goes further. It actually bars the agency from effectively enforcing the legal standards that have been adopted to protect our water. In essence, it is telling the agency that they can't do what they haven't already been doing. Now, as frustrating as it is with the current agency actions, this bill makes it even worse by an order of magnitude, as it actually bars them from doing their duty. It's a dangerous precedent, and it would actually state the will of the legislature that the state not implement the Federal Clean Water Act. And Ms. Hoffman has indicated some of the ramifications of that. I think it would be wiser to leave the agency the leeway to do their work, to work through their process, and let's not make matters worse by defying Federal Clean Water Act. We need to defend Minnesota traditions by protecting our state grain for all of its many traditions and benefits. We are fortunate in Minnesota. We are the only one with a standard like this, but we're also the only state. We are the state with by far the largest natural occurring populations of wild rice in the country. As a matter of fact, I think it's in the North American continent. But this is about more than wild rice. It's also about standing up for our Minnesota traditions of figuring out how to protect our great outdoors for future generations, and how to problem solve by finding ways to reduce polluting discharges and not lowering or suspending our standards for short-term gains. It's about the job of figuring out what steps are needed to be taken to protect our resources and, at the same time, to move iron mining ahead in a manner that provides long-term viability, not a short-term fix. What is needed is a workable process to meet both of these goals. It is also, and I don't want to miss the point made by Ms. Hoffman, it is about the cold and tragic statistic that 1 in 10 children born in the St. Louis River, the Lake Superior Basin, have excessive levels of mercury in their blood when they are born. As the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, we know that Minnesotans expect their leaders not to roll back the laws that provide the bedrock of Minnesota's policies that protect our lakes, rivers, and streams. Please meet these expectations and oppose the legislation that's before you. This bill limits agency authority to protect our water, and it limits our ability to do that. And I'll be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Mr. Morris or Ms. Huffman, have other states lost EPA authority? I mean, how many states fill in for the EPA in doing some of the Clean Water Act? How many states have that authority to do that for the EPA, and have any of them lost that?
Sure. So I don't know the number off the top of my head of this, all the states that are delegated. It's a high number. Most states have that authority. The EPA has not taken the step of withdrawing that authority. However, it has taken lesser steps with great ramifications on states. So, for instance, and there's a good example in Arkansas. In 2013, the Arkansas legislature passed a bill not unlike this one that attempted to roll back a water quality standard that had been approved by the EPA related to drinking water sources. The EPA informed them that that was not an option that was available to them, and the EPA then threatened to, well, didn't threaten, but they decided that the EPA needed to take a new role in Arkansas, and that role was to examine every single water quality permit that was issued. Ordinarily, the EPA only looks at a select number, but in Arkansas, they said, you know what, we're concerned about your enforcement of your water quality standards. We're going to look at every single one. So the agencies in Arkansas had to spend months trying to rewrite the rules in a way that the EPA approved of. The EPA ultimately ended up with a partial withdrawal of delegation for certain permits, and the Arkansas legislation held a special session in which they repealed the law because they decided it was too much of a headache. So the EPA is certainly prepared to take some fairly extensive measures in response to this kind of legislative action.
Thank you. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either of the testifiers, could you please explain a little bit more the science behind, and I realize that you're not from the Department of Health, but I just want to understand more the science of how the newborns in that water basin are ending up with the mercury in their brains, because obviously the newborns aren't consuming the fish directly. So could you please play that out for us a little more?
Yes, Chairman, members of the committee. Let me start from the beginning a little bit. Mercury is typically an air pollutant. It's emitted from smokestacks around the world and in Minnesota, mostly coal, although there are other sources. And it travels around the world. So although some of the mercury that we have here comes from Minnesota sources, some of it comes from other regions or either in even other countries. Once it is airborne, it settles into water bodies. And in that format, the form that it comes out of the smokestacks and the form that it settles into water bodies, it's actually not that harmful. But once it settles into the water and it gets into especially stagnant areas like wetlands, sulfate becomes a key component. Sulfate encourages a chemical reaction by which mercury changes from the form that it comes out of the smokestacks to the form that it gets absorbed into fish, and that's called methylmercury. Once it becomes methylmercury, it gets into the fish, and then people consume the fish. In the case of newborns, that means the fish was consumed by a pregnant mother. We have fish advisories, of course, and they are a direct result of fish consumption advisories, and they're a direct result of this mercury methylation process. But, of course, there are people who are members of indigenous populations that subsist off of fish or are not aware of these or so forth. And in general, we shouldn't have them anyway. It's not good enough to just tell people not to eat the fish. We should be trying to make the fish healthy to eat. The St. Louis River has a particularly high level of mercury in the fish tissue, and we don't know exactly why, but it also has a high level of pollution from legacy mining problems. So until we know more about that, this really isn't the time to be rolling back our sulfate standards when we know that there is a key relationship there.
And Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Morris.
If I could just on that note, Mr. Chairman and Senator, the survey of newborns was done, I believe it was the entire Lake Superior Basin, and so northern Michigan was included in that survey. Northern Wisconsin was included in that survey, and the numbers were much lower. I don't remember what they were, but the Lake Superior Basin in Minnesota and this area of the whole Lake Superior Basin really stuck out, and there weren't these heavy exceedances in other parts of the region.
Thank you both. We have Paula Maccabee and John Hottinger next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Paula McAbee, and I serve as the Advocacy Director and Counsel for Water Legacy, a nonprofit group formed to protect Minnesota's water resources and the communities that rely on them. Our 10,000 members include people who hunt, fish, and gather wild rice, as well as teachers, chemists, and biologists. They have identified wild rice as an indicator species for Arrowhead region ecosystems and have also made the preservation of water quality standards in the face of political pressure a high priority. Let me just respond to a couple of things that came up in the discussion. The question was asked, how does methylmercury get into newborns? And the answer is, as mothers eat fish, the methylmercury accumulates in their bones. And at the stage of fetal development where the fetal bones are developed, that mercury crosses the placental barrier. And so actually, infants in utero get even a higher dose of mercury than the moms who actually ate the fish. Another issue that I heard in the prior testimony is that this file, Senate File 1007, which Water Legacy opposes, is actually no different than the 2011 session file. There's one key difference. The session file in 2011, in paragraph E, said that the PCA would exercise its authority to ensure to the fullest extent possible that money wasn't spent to enforce the standard. But it had a very critical phrase that is not contained in any of the bills today, which says to the extent allowable under the Federal Clean Water Act. And what the Environmental Protection Agency and the Pollution Control Agency correctly interpreted is that as the Clean Water Act is written today and as it was written in 2011, the Pollution Control Agency does not have the latitude to fail to make that enforcement. This language in 2011 was written with a anticipation or possibly the pipe dream that the Clean Water Act would change at the federal level. So that language is quite different, and this bill really does ask for a new effort, and that is to suspend the wild rice sulfate standard, which is an approved water quality standard, and to do so without requiring compliance with the Clean Water Act. Now, Water Legacy has been active in preserving the wild rice sulfate standard since 2009. We've reviewed all the pages in the MPCA dating back to 1973 when the standard was enacted. So if you have questions about the files, hopefully I'll remember them. When the Chamber of Commerce sued the state in 2011 to prevent enforcement of the wild rice sulfate standard, Water Legacy intervened in court. And the Chamber's claims were much like what you heard today about the need to designate wild rice waters, the fact it was not a complete standard. And the Chamber's claims were defeated both in district court and at the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today, Water Legacy opposes adoption of Senate File 1007 on two grounds. First, the scientific evidence gathered as a result of $1.5 million in taxpayer-funded research demonstrates that prohibiting enforcement of the existing standard would be unreasonable. Second, and I think Ms. Hoffman went into quite a bit of detail, so I may abbreviate some of my talk, legislation preventing the Pollution Control Agency from fulfilling its obligations to control sulfate pollution and list wild rice impaired waters would conflict with the Clean Water Act, which is governing federal law. First, Minnesota's existing 10 milligrams per liter wild rice sulfate standard is reasonable and should be enforced. In 2011, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency hired the best scientists from the University of Minnesota and engaged in the most comprehensive study of wild rice and sulfate anywhere in the world. As a result of this research, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency concluded in February 2014, number one, sulfate is not directly toxic to wild rice. However, sulfate in the water can be converted by bacteria to sulfide in the rooting zone of wild rice, and that sulfide is toxic to wild rice. Now, that wasn't a surprise to the scientists. Actually, John Moyle had written a memo to the Pollution Control Agency in 1975 explaining that that was believed to be the mechanism. So far, no surprises. And then the PCA also wrote in February 2014, quote, the 10 milligram per liter sulfate standard is needed and reasonable to protect wild rice production from sulfate-driven sulfide toxicity. Also, quote, the 10 milligram per liter wild rice sulfate standard should continue to apply to both lakes and streams. Now, the response to an internal briefing, a response of Iron Range legislators to this report, was swift and critical. The MPCA's proposal was withdrawn, and a new conceptual draft was prepared. And a first draft was done in March 2014 and a more elaborate draft in June 2014. And that draft concept was provided to a panel of seven international scientists on a peer review panel, completely independent scientists. And these scientists had a hearing last August, and they issued a final report in September. And they reviewed basically the same concept that here's today, which is the concept that the PCA would substitute a formula for a limit on sulfate pollution. And these are some of the quotes from the peer review report. Quote, "It would be useful to have an experiment that examines whether iron would mitigate the ecological effects of wild rice on wild rice of added sulfide levels. MPCA needs to understand the mechanism of toxicity better before claiming to understand how iron mitigates sulfide stress." And I understand from some of the news coverage that Dr. Pastor is now doing some of that research in order to find out in the laboratory if this hypothesis is valid. And the peer review also said, if MPCA is going to make site-specific standards based on iron and sulfate concentrations and compare these conditions with the hydroponic studies to determine a no observed effect level, the sulfate concentration determined will not be protective. Now, the MPCA mentioned that they were looking at what level of sulfide would protect 90% of the presence of wild rice. That's not the correct legal standard. Standards for toxicity are supposed to be based on the no observed effect level, not the level at which some fragment of the resource, whether it's fish or whether it's rice or whether it's anything else, survives. So we have a hypothesis here that hasn't been proved in laboratory that is based on something which is not the appropriate standard for regulation. Both wild rice researchers and the independent scientific experts believe that the MPCA's new formula is at best not ready for prime time and at worst scientifically indefensible. But the industry, the mining industry, seems pleased with this new development. The Arkansas legislature recently went down a similar path. They weakened standards for pollutants, including sulfates and chlorides, as a result of pressure by the El Dorado Chemical Company. Under the federal regulations, and that's if for any lawyers in the room, 40 CFR 131.5, the EPA disapproved the weaker standard championed by the chemical company, and the chemical company sued the EPA. And just last summer, our Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed summary judgment for the EPA. And the federal court explained that in order to change a water quality standard, the state has the burden to prove that its proposal will be protective of existing uses. In that case, the state has to prove that what they're doing is going to protect wild rice. Next, not only are we concerned that the standard of a formula is untested and it wouldn't approve wild rice, we are also concerned that moving forward with Senate File 1007, stating that the PCA cannot apply what is now an enacted law that has been adopted under the Clean Water Act and approved by the EPA, that doing this would be inconsistent with the Clean Water Act. And I'm going to quote a different part of the letter that Ms. Hoffman referred to, which was sent to legislators on May 13, 2011, when the state of Minnesota was again proposing to suspend the wild rice sulfate standard. This is what the EPA said. A state with a federally authorized NPDES permit program is required to issue permits that ensure the protection of federally approved water quality standards. Where a state proposes to issue a permit that fails to apply or to ensure compliance with any applicable requirement, including water quality-based effluent requirements, EPA has the authority to review and to object to such permit issuance pursuant to its authority. If the state issues a permit despite that warning, the federal government has the power to take over the permit. The mining industry's challenge to the wild rice sulfate standard has been all over the news this month. In an interview this week with Minnesota Public Radio, which is now available online, discussing the existing sulfate standard, the limit of 10 milligrams per liter in wild rice waters, Governor Mark Dayton stated that U.S. Steel, quote, has made it very clear that they're not going to agree to a permit that has a standard of 10. I suggest we all try that next time we're pulled over for speeding. Officer, I don't agree to comply with a 30 mile per hour speed limit. I'm not sure it would work for me. It doesn't work under the Clean Water Act either. The Clean Water Act does not allow polluters to choose which regulations they will and will not comply with, and does not support states if they give in to industry pressure instead of enforcing the law. Again, in 2011, the EPA advised the Minnesota legislature, our own legislature, should EPA determine that a state is not administering its federally approved permit program in accordance with the requirements of the Clean Water Act, EPA has the authority to require the state to take corrective action and, if necessary, to withdraw authorization of the program. I put copies of federal regulations that have to do with the EPA's power to withdraw state authority to regulate water quality in your packets. Among the circumstances that would justify withdrawal are failure to issue permits, issuing permits that don't protect beneficial uses, failure to act on permit violations, and action by a state legislature or court striking down or limiting state authorities. This is only right because laws were made to protect all of us, not just the powerful. My dad died about 1 year ago. He used to tell me to stand up to bullies. Every time a political fix is proposed to serve the interests of a particular industry, Minnesota slips farther away from my dad's common sense and farther away from Clean Water Act requirements to control pollution, to protect wild rice, to protect fish, to protect ecological communities, and to protect human health, all of which depend on clean water. At some point, we fear Minnesota's legitimacy in serving as the regulator of the mining industry and other pollutants will reach the point where our state's authority can no longer be defended or sustained. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. McAbee. Mr. Hottinger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. My name is John Hottinger. I'm here representing the North Star chapter of the Sierra Club. The North Star chapter is the leading grassroots voice to preserve and protect Minnesota's environment with over 14,000 members. We oppose activities that increase immediate adverse environmental impacts, such as weakening sound, water, and air protection standards in a way that creates unsustainable pollution. We do not support Senate File 1007 because of the threat it would pose to wild rice. I've spent much of my time so far during the hearing crossing out things I'm going to say because Mr. Morris and Ms. Hoffman and Ms. McAbee have been eloquent and detailed in outlining the problems with this proposed legislation. There was a hearing about a month ago in the House on a companion piece of legislation at which advocates and opponents presented lengthy testimony, including key testimony from local experts or legal experts about the conflict with the controlling role of the Environmental Protection Agency. You've heard that testimony here, and I won't repeat it. But today we do have a different situation than was evident in the House. We have an MPCA that has answered the supporters' constant plea during the House hearing to name the lakes, because that was of vital importance. We now have a draft list of 1,300 waters, which are wild rice waters, that would be impacted by the standard, and as importantly, a proposal to refine that list to make sure it's accurate and the proper lakes. Today we have a pathway to resolution based on a scientific proposition for further scientific evaluation with plans to follow it up in the rulemaking process, which House supporters said was the goal of this bill. To quote, to be sure that this critical rulemaking process takes place. Most importantly, the science also confirms that we do not abandon the current standard and open the door to potential contamination of wild rice lakes while we go through that process. It really goes back to a medical maxim, primum non noci re, first do no harm. This should serve as the ethical basis for the decision you are being asked to make about what to do between now and the time that new rule comes out. Do no harm. Keeping this standard in effect would be the best way to do that during the interim. it would be a poor ethical decision because of dissatisfaction with the standard that we abandon it and leave nothing in place to deal with the potential negative effects on wild rice, our state grain, and culturally and economically significant resource to native peoples with whom we have treaties protecting wild rice. The bill was designed to compel action from MPSA, and it accomplished that purpose to the extent we now have a draft list of lakes, a scientific proposal to be evaluated, and a time frame for coming up with an updated standard. In the meantime, it would be a definable risk to abandon the protection now provided. Next, for 2 years, allowing commercial interests to document their potential costs, hopefully, to help us evaluate that as a factor. But one final note, and it's a note that, frankly, because this meeting was called with relatively short notice, I think the Sierra Club wants to step up on. At both the national and local level, the Sierra Club has a strong and firm commitment to environmental justice. Environmental justice involves assuring that fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all persons, regardless of race or income, when making environmental decisions. In the hearing, with a longer time frame before the process, we heard from tribal communities and the impact of wild rice. Fair treatment means that no group of people should bear a disproportionate share of the negative environmental consequences resulting from industrial, governmental, and commercial policies and operations. This is a situation rife with environmental justice implications. Wild rice has a special cultural, spiritual role with many Native communities and cultures. It's the subject of important treaties between our nations. To abandon this standard now, when we have reached the goal of the legislation, at least as testified to the House, of a designated rulemaking process, would be an injustice once again, allowing disproportionate share of the negative environmental consequences resulting from industrial, governmental, and commercial operations to fall in a group of people who have too often been located near the sites of commercial pollution, adding wild rice impairment to the damage already impacting Native peoples in this country and this state from nuclear waste pollution decisions and other air and water pollution concentrations. It would once again disregard treaties made to provide wild rice protection. It's of essential importance that we go through the consultations that the MPCA has plans. It's essential that we allow Native peoples to have a voice in the discussions before we make these kinds of changes. As Senator Tomasoni has suggested, the best solution would be to put this bill on the table at the very least and let the process proceed with all due haste and with all due parties involved in the process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members, for your time, attention, and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Hottinger. We have two more, and the last one was told only if there's time available, and I think they're about 6 or 7 minutes. Bob Tamman and William Hain, welcome to the committee.
Are we up now?
You can go up there, sir, if you want. If there's enough time after Mr. Tamman, they're about 5 and a half minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Tamman. The agenda listed me as being from Aurora, but my wife Pat and I live in Sudan, home of Minnesota's first iron mine. And it's been some very interesting testimony today. And I think one thing we should acknowledge is that this 10 milligrams per liter sulfate standard is not a comply or die standard. That's been acknowledged at this testimony. This standard has been around since 73, and we haven't really forced compliance. Now we're making a little noise about it, but still, I checked Minnesota rules before I came to this meeting today, and we still have 7050.0190 variance from standards. Now I'll read a couple sentences. If strict enforcement would cause undue hardship, the agency, in its discretion, may grant a variance. The agency does that. We have a safety valve. you know, people point out how difficult it's going to be to meet this 10 milligrams per standard, 10 milligrams per liter standard. But I started working in the iron mines over 45 years ago, and I've seen a few hard times and some companies go bankrupt. As far as I know, it's never been radical environmentalist or enforcement of environmental regulations. It's been an economy similar to the one we have now or 2 or 3 years ago. Taconite pellets were close to $200 a ton. Now they're $50. I don't think we should be asked to believe that our environmental standards are shutting down KeyTac. A 75% decline in the price of pellets is shutting down KeyTac. Another administrative rule still in force, 7001.0160. If a company applies for a reissue of a permit in a timely manner, the company can continue to conduct the permitted activity on the expired permit. And this is especially interesting to me because I worked at U.S. Steel's Minntac plant. And we've heard about their leaking tailings pond. I drove out in the dike of that leaking tailings pond. 45 years ago it was leaking, and it's still leaking today. Even though their permit expired in 1992, they're still running on that expired permit. And I haven't heard any whining from the mining company that they want quick action on that expired permit. They love that expired permit. I believe our agencies have worked with our industry to the benefit of industry and probably to the people of Minnesota to a certain extent. My neighbors work in the mines. It's not that I want to pull the plug on the mines, but I certainly don't support Senate File 1007 that would take away enforcement authority, because I believe as technology becomes available, our agencies can put pressure on the mines to use this technology. Now, as I mentioned, Minntac's tailings pond is leaking right now as we speak, but the company has started pumping the water back on the east side of that tailings pond. That's the side that drains into Lake Vermilion, where, of course, Senator Bach has some interest. I don't know if that's why they pump back, but anyhow, we have made a little progress on our leaking tailings ponds. And I would hope that as years go by, reverse osmosis, maybe we'll have some breakthroughs that become more economical, that we can actually start to use that. But why would the company use it if we say we can't enforce the sulfate standard? So, as a Minnesota resident, somebody who worked in the mines, I would like to see the MPCA retain their authority to enforce our discharge standards with the possibility of using a variance where necessary, and with the authority to push the mines to use the best available technology. And we've seen that they've rug in the wastewater treatment plants as a talking point. And I think we should recall that there's a little difference between a wastewater treatment plant and a mining company. A wastewater treatment plant takes dirty water and makes it cleaner. A mining company takes clean water and makes it dirtier. We can very well have a few nuances in our policy towards those two entities. With that, I realize the day is getting short, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Tamman. And we are about out of time, so, sir, I will ask if you are willing to send in writing to the committee. We will be glad to share with members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming, though. Senator Tomasoni.
So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for being patient. Thank you for sitting through this, and thank you for understanding what an important issue this is. You know, we're talking about our very way of life on the Iron Range, and for the people here who think that we don't care about clean water and clean air, we care very much about it. In fact, we have some of the cleanest air and some of the cleanest water in the entire state, and we've been mining for over 130 years, so we know how to mine and we know what we're doing. The whole point of this particular bill is the fact that the 2011 legislation was intended to have the MPCA
do exactly what they're doing, and that is going through a rulemaking process and promulgate rules because of the fact that we have the science that is now telling us that the 10 is not an accurate number, and we know for sure that there are many different ways of coming to conclusions, but that when you have results like 1,600 and 2,500 parts per million of sulfate not harming the wild rice, that's what we're talking about here today. We heard comments about mercury. Well, 90% of our mercury comes from outside of the state, and we have very, very stringent mercury standards already. And in fact, Chisholm, Buell, and Kinney just put in a brand new wastewater treatment plant, and they're talking about having to spend another $5 million to meet the mercury standards, which is an indication of how difficult some of these standards actually are, because if the latest technology doesn't meet it and the newest technology doesn't meet it, then how do we get there? You know, there's all kinds of talk about the wild rice dying or not dying or being in one place and not being there now. But we actually heard people who harvest the wild rice saying that the wild rice is aplenty. So what we don't know is if we apply the standard, what we don't know is if it will make the wild rice flourish or die, or not flourish. We don't know that because the standard hasn't been applied since 1973, wild rice is still growing. So if we suddenly make mining companies and wastewater treatment plants and paper mills and ethanol plants suddenly apply a standard that hasn't been applied before, we don't know if it's going to be a waste of all kinds of money and very, very costly to the people of Minnesota, because we don't know if applying the standard will actually keep the wild rice more healthy or not. And so it's the kind of thing that we should be prudent before we go through with this standard, and we shouldn't be requiring new permits to meet the 10 standard without the MPCA coming up with the final rules here. And so there's a reason that we put in law that they can't require companies to make huge expenditures to meet the standard, and that is because it might not be the right one. And so why should somebody spend $220 million to clean up their water when 10 might not be the right or appropriate standard? And so what we're trying to do here, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is we're trying to work this out, and we're trying to get to the right answer, because my very way of life is being threatened on the Iron Range. And do no harm. I'm going to tell you what. No mining jobs on the Iron Range does an awful lot of harm. And unless we get this thing right, this could be the start of something even bigger than what people have been talking about here, because, yes, the world economy affects us very, very badly. In fact, I've always said that when the steel industry gets a hiccup, we get the flu on the Iron Range. But I will tell you that this is another factor that hasn't been factored in before, because they haven't had to comply with the standards since 1973, and all of a sudden we're talking about spending millions and millions of dollars, and the boardrooms out east are going to take a look at somewhere else. I can tell you that right now, and it will be a big, big deal. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that we can lay this on the table, maybe possibly consider it later in the session when we maybe have some consensus on how to proceed.
Sir Tomasoni, we will lay the bill on the table as you request. I do want to say, and I think the committee's listened very patiently for a couple hours, and I think everybody in the room understands that taconite mining is a major part of Minnesota, and it's something that's provided us a lot of good things. And I think we also recognize our waters are very important and also a high value for Minnesota. And I think the difficulty with your bill is we're basically saying that even though, and again, you keep saying 1970s standard, but again, that 2011 legislation asked the agency to look at it, and their findings were that 10 was a defensible, enforceable, and a good standard to use, and they are going to figure it out more on a lake-by-lake type of approach, but I think it misstates it to say that's a really old standard that doesn't have any scientific justification. I do think, in terms of saying that we're not going to do, the agency is going to be to have its hands tied by the legislature, we can't enforce federal law, I think that's real problems for not just federal law, but for the tribes, for the water. And I do think that one of the things I hope we can start doing today and this year may not be the year to do it, but I think we have to start looking at the long-term thing where, you know, mining doesn't go away. MINTAC is not going to go away because some people wish it would, and the water quality problems aren't going to go away because some people ignore it. I mean, the cost of cleanup this, regardless of whether they're mining or not, I mean, that's about 12 square miles of lake in the basin that's toxic. And under our federal Superfund laws, I believe it's the polluter pays, so it's on their liabilities whether they acknowledge it or not. And so I think we ought to be sitting down and looking what new technologies are available. I think Senator Schmidt has a bill on a new water technology type of business cluster. He thinks there's an idea for a lot of growth of jobs in Minnesota there. I think looking at new technologies, looking at how we deal with the costs of cleanup, I think we would do as well. I'm going to drop in a bill that missed deadlines. It won't be going anywhere this year, but a bill that says, why don't we ask the DNR to pull together a stakeholder process with the tribes, pull it together with the mining interests, pull it together with the environmental groups and local governments, and try and figure out how, instead of pretending the other side doesn't exist, that we work out some way to come up with answers to this, because it doesn't serve us well to have the political fights here at the Capitol or the legal fights year after year, because I think you could take a poll of Minnesotans anywhere in the state and they'd say iron mining is important to Minnesota, and I think they'd also say clean water is important to Minnesota. And even though the standard directly relates to wild rice, I think the impact on methylmercury, and I mean, I think those are horrifying, the statistics from Health Department 4 years ago or so about how more than one in 10 kids there are being born with dangerous levels of mercury in their blood. So that doesn't address this bill, which again, I think is, even if the legislature were to pass this, I don't think it's going to have an impact, because I think it just shifts it to the courts then, and I don't think you accomplish that. But I do think we ought to recognize that there are plenty of people who are very passionate on issues related to mining and the environment, and I think we have to start finding a way, a better process to try and not pretend like they're going to go away if we ignore the issue. So I'll drop in a bill and share it with you in a few days, but you withdrew the bill today, and I realize I assume you should be talking with everybody involved on your own right now on how to deal with this. But,
and Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I agree with all your statements about whether or not the 10 is defensible based on the science that was just done, because there's a conclusion right in the report that 1,600 parts per million does not harm the wild rice, and so and the science done by the Chamber of Commerce goes up as high as 2,500. So I think there's some very serious questions about whether or not the science will support the 10. But also, you know, we get our water out of our mine pits up on the Iron Range, and it's clean water, and it's very clean water. In fact, Buell bottles its water, and it is bragging to have the cleanest water in the United States. And so to say that because we're mining, we're dirtying the water is not true. And in fact, the mining companies, of their own volition, and of course with the help of the MPCA, have spent millions and millions of dollars on environmental cleanup. And in fact, we have mineland reclamation that we have put in on our own, because we realize how important the future is and how important the environment is. And so this is an attempt to get to the right answer. This is an attempt to make sure that we aren't putting something in these permits that is going to be so onerous that boardrooms are going to decide not to keep these mines open. And I, quite frankly, just want to make sure we get it right. And that's what this is all about today.
Thank you. With that Senator Thomasoni request that we lay over the Senate file 1007 as amended. And is there any further discussion from members of the committee? If not, we will adjourn. And
Senator Murray.
go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't realize you were going to gavel out on adjournment. Just so I can, our members understand, where are we looking at after we come back from Easter break? Are we look? This is a policy committee. We've actually finished second deadline now. I'm sort of curious on where you're going to be going in the next week or two after we come back.
We do have some confirmations we have to deal with. I'm not sure how many. We dealt with the commissioners, and I think we dealt with the PUC. We have a handful of other boards and so on, I believe. But that should be it. And I wish everybody a good and relaxing break in the next week. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.